This is In the Discovery, a Star Trek reboot fic written by Stage Longsama, read by Rena Jenkins. The story is rated M for tons of swearing in sexual situations, with pairings OCs, Spock, and Spock McCoy. There are mild spoilers for the reboot movie and some mentions of the original series, but nothing big. Uhura. The best part about being a xenolinguist, aside from the intellectual stimulation, is the complete confidence it provides. Uhura has never felt isolated or trapped purely from a communication standpoint, and there's something wonderful about the way language reforms under her tongue during translation. She appreciates each word's turn and curve, how each sound is formed differently and slots together on her lips. The nuanced meanings are familiar, like the pages of an old book of fairy tales that she has hidden under her bunk. Uhura loves her job, every bit of translation and communication, and she's damn good at it. What Uhura does not love are other crew members' attempts to seduce Spock right in front of her. Uhura knows flirting when she sees it. Just another language, complete with nuanced meanings and words, even if they are unspoken. The scuttlebutt on the Enterprise had focused onto the Vulcan after the news of their parting. Amicable, but still awkward, though Uhura will personally kick down the door of whoever hurt Spock and acquaint them with her other skills, had dripped down through the ranks. It's no secret, except to Spock, just how desired he is. Before, Spock had been mysterious, aloof, and strikingly handsome. But Uhura's. Now he's unattached, and in need of someone to sweep him up after the destruction of his home planet. Vultures, Uhura thinks, and can't help it. She'd seen the shiver in his hands, the cold sweat on the back of his neck when he'd returned with a fraction of the Vulcan Elders. Spock had missed the worst of it, being in transport when the rest of Vulcan perished, but she was sure he could hear their dying screams echoing in the other survivors' minds. Perhaps it's uncharitable, but Uhura can't quite squash the anger that simmers in her when people go after Spock, who, right now, wants nothing more than to lick his wounds in private. And when someone first attempts to pursue a more than colleague's relationship with Spock, she can see from Kirk's expression that she is not the only one protective of the Enterprise's CSO. For all his obnoxious bravado, Kirk is still someone who has long-shouldered tragedy as an integral part of his identity. He knows personally what Uhura can only grasp abstractly, though her throat still tightens at the memory of Gala, beautiful, effervescent Gala, and she is suddenly grateful she cannot understand further than that. A pretty young ensign, and Uhura huffs at her own judgment, the ensign is, at most, a year or two younger than her, is the first to try and worm her way in with Spock. She stands close to him on the bridge, and Spock, too polite to take a step away from her, locks his hands firmly behind his back as he explains the answer to the ensign's questions. Uhura can see the tension in the taut lines of Spock's spine. She frowns and glances over at Kirk. He holds her gaze for a moment, mirroring her expression, before his eyes slide back to Spock. "The matter is quite simple, Ensign, and I suggest you review the records if you still face confusion." "Commander Spock," she presses, stepping closer, "would you please go over that last bit once more? I want to make sure I get your full meaning. You are so much more interesting than a few record tapes." Her proximity to Spock indicates just how much more interesting she thinks Spock is, as well as gives them a degree of privacy. "I'm curious," says the angle of her head. "About you," adds the curve in her smile. "It is quite simple," Spock tries again, eyes flickering up to meet Uhura's. "Perhaps Lieutenant Uhura could further clarify things, if need be. She is unmatched in the field of communication." The ensign opens her mouth to protest. Uhura is halfway out of her chair, ready to intervene. "Back to your post, Ensign Trent," Kirk's voice cuts across the bridge. "Leave the commander to his duties." Trent jumps and scurries off with a hasty salute. Spock sinks back into his chair. Uhura pretends not to notice his relief. Later, Uhura overhears Trent and her friends in the mess. Someone had misinformed Ensign Trent that if she projected her emotions loudly enough, Vulcans were unable to resist surrendering to them. Briefly, Uhura considers informing Reminding, for God's sake, that Vulcans are touch telepaths. Instead, Trent receives an order to attend extra xenosociology modules during her off-shift hours. Kirk gets wind of it, judging from the subtle thumbs up he gives Uhura the next morning on the bridge. And then it continues. Uhura is in the transporter room, waiting to beam down for shore leave, when Spock arrives to accompany her. The captain insisted. He says, to her curious expression, "I have been ordered to relax." He has one eyebrow quirked at the irony, and Uhura can't help a snort of laughter. "And he'll still disobey that, I bet," Kirk announces as he strolls in. "I must be the only captain in Starfleet who has a backseat driver." "Captain," Spock protests, "that metaphor is inaccurate, as you are not the helmsman, and therefore currently not in control of the motor functions of the Enterprise." Kirk waves him off. "Yeah, Spock, I got it. Look, just beam down, okay? I'll be there in a few hours." Spock nods and walks onto the transporter pad. Uhura starts to follow, but Kirk's hand on her shoulder stops her. "Keep an eye on him," Kirk murmurs. "I do it myself, but Pike's about to have an aneurysm over these new regulations." "Is that an order, Captain? While I'm on shore leave?" Kirk elbows her. "You know it's not, Uhura, and I know you'll do it even without my asking." He smiles at her, nods at Spock, and is headed back to the bridge before Uhura can comment further. She steps up onto the transporter pad. Energize. Kirk's right, of course, Uhura thinks as the Enterprise fades around her. She'll step in if Spock needs an escape plan. Uhura suspects that there won't be much need to consider that, since half the crew is terrified of Spock, and the other half of Uhura, Kirk, and/or McCoy. Not all of them were on the Enterprise when they took down Nero, and myth is more powerful than the reality. And the reality is that while they're all very good at what they do, they were also exceedingly lucky. But that still doesn't prevent Lieutenant Galway from biology from taking a crack at Spock. Galway slips up next to Spock while Uhura is retrieving drinks for them, and they're mid-conversation when she spots them on her way back. Uhura stops. She can't barge in and chase off Galway. A Spock outranks her after all, and he can fight his own battles, but she'll sure as hell monitor the situation. "As you said, Lieutenant Galway, the constellations and celestial characteristics of this planet are most fascinating. It is due to the thin atmosphere of the planet that we were able to see such physical entities clearly without aid." "How interesting," Galway says. "Commander, may I be so bold as to ask for your company this evening?" Spock tips his head, considering her offer. "I am currently engaged in social activities with Lieutenant Uhura at present." "Perhaps later?" Galway offers with a coy smirk. "Perhaps much later," says the turn of her corner of her mouth, the angle of her shoulders into Spock's space. "I could not say. There is currently no foreseeable conclusion to this evening," Spock replies. Galway lays a hand on his arm, thankfully on cloth, rather than skin. Still, Spock stiffens at the contact. "Now, just who are you spying on, Uhura?" Uhura jumps at McCoy's voice just behind her. She gives him a warning look and jerks her head in Spock's direction. "Well, that doesn't look too good," McCoy murmurs, and when Uhura turns back, it is to see Spock approaching them at a rather brisk pace. Galway stares after him, confused. Wordlessly, Uhura holds up Spock's drink, and he takes a long sip from it. Uhura waits for him to compose himself before she lets her curiosity get the better of her. McCoy, however, is not that patient. "Good God, man, you look like someone who's just been fed turkey and told it was possum." "I regret to say that your estimation of the situation ventures close to the truth," Spock replies, "though the deception is not applicable." "What happened?" Uhura asks. "I believe I require more fermented beverages before I can divulge such information." "Now hold on a minute. I thought you said the Vulcans were unaffected by alcohol," McCoy cuts in, and Uhura has to laugh at the outrage in McCoy's voice. "I am half-human, and I believe this requires further scientific investigation before I can form a definitive hypothesis." And Spock strides for the bar. McCoy runs after him, Uhura on his trail as he shouts ahead, gleefully, to the bartender, "This round is on me!" As it turns out, Spock's human side is present enough that he can get a little tipsy after several drinks. It is then that he informs McCoy and Uhura that Lieutenant Galway offered to take him to a restaurant where the specialty was a spicy dish composed mainly of grilled celot meat. "She didn't know you're a vegetarian?" McCoy asks. "Is that all?" Uhura explains what a celot is. McCoy gets Spock another drink, and Uhura hides a smile as McCoy explains the logical benefits of the neon pink shots he's just bought them. "Keep you from thinking too much," he rumbles, and then explains how to do a shot. When Kirk arrives, it is to find McCoy explaining to Spock the various animals that are considered domestic pets on different parts of Earth, but considered delicacies in other parts of the galaxy. Should I be more surprised that Spock smells like Andorian liquor, or that they're talking nicely? Kirk asks Uhura. Uhura grins and takes the opportunity to fill Kirk in. Galway approaches Uhura a few days after they've shipped out. They're in one of the lounges, and the only other occupants are a pair of security officers playing cards in the corner. "Yoda," she begins, "what's a salat, exactly?" Uhura blinks at her, but recovers smoothly from her surprise. It's like a living teddy bear, but they have 6-inch fangs and claws. Some run wild, but they were a common pet for Vulcan children. Galway's face flushes. "Oh, thanks." "Oh, and Kim?" Uhura calls over her shoulder as she turns back to the pad in front of her. "Vulcans are vegetarians." Kirk. Jim Kirk will be the first to admit that living and working on a starship isn't exactly the easiest job in the universe. There's constant mortal danger, a limited space to move around in, and a limited number of people to get involved with. Of course, as captain, Jim's not allowed to do that last one. He doesn't mind. That's what shore leave is for, after all. But that doesn't mean he wants to sit and watch varying members of his crew attempt to lure Spock into their quarters. If Spock picks up on the subtleties of human seduction. Jim doesn't know much about Vulcan seduction, and Spock had given him a rather nasty glare when he'd asked. Still, he is fairly certain that Spock has some idea of what's going on, if the fact that those neutral expressions of his were starting to get strained were any clue. But Jim can't keep an eye on Spock all the time, which makes him glad that Uhura appears to be in complete agreement with him. He hadn't been sure if it could count on McCoy for the same. The doctor had turned purple and chased Jim out of sickbay when the subject had been broached, but then he'd spotted the old softy chasing away other crew members when Spock was having a bad side effects, an affection toward anything breathing, from a booster. Of course, the attempts don't stop, they just seem to heighten in peculiarity. "Spock," Jim begins casually one night, as Spock sets up a chess set in his quarters. "Mind if I ask about these?" And he waves to a bouquet of electric blue blossoms in a vase on Spock's desk. "Whether I mind or not, you will still ask, Jim." Jim grins. "Yeah, you're right. So, who gave you the flowers?" "Engineer Larson." Jim blinks. "Seriously? Jeff Larson gave you flowers?" "I can assure you that my preference would be for this to be a prank." Spock joins Jim at his desk. "However, I regret to say that the engineer presented these to me during my off hours in what I can only assume is a courtship ritual." He touches one of the petals and shows Jim the vivid pink pollen that sticks to his fingers. While they are visually pleasing, the amount of pollen produced is quite unpleasant. Jim is suspicious. "What kind of flower are they?" "It appears to be a distant relative of the Amaryllidaceae species, judging from the shape of the blossoms. I believe Lieutenant Sulu will be able to give you a more thorough explanation." "I don't think that'll be necessary," Jim assures him. Jim might not know as much as Sulu does about plants, but he's an expert on aphrodisiac mythology, and Jim is just about sure that those flowers on Spock's desk are rumored to be just that for Vulcans. "Another urban legend bites the dust," Jim thinks with a smile. "So, why'd you keep him, Spock?" "I was under the impression that humans perceived it as an affront if gifts were refused." "You have a little more leeway if they're trying to get into your pants." Spock raises an eyebrow at the slang, but says nothing. He sits on one side of the chessboard, and Jim takes the other. Never thought you'd been into men. You humans have a peculiar obsession with classifying your sexuality in definite terms when the subject itself exists in a fluid state. Spock answers smoothly, moving a pawn. Was that just you coming out to me? I failed to see the need when I was never in. Jim grins. Touché, Spock. And lets Spock take his knight. And then it gets weirder. So there was no effect? Based on the recently passed experience, I can assure you there was not, Jim. Huh, I thought there would be. There was not. Well, I know that, Spock. I'm just saying I thought there would be one. I do not understand your reasoning. I don't know, they're kind of unusual, and you get cranky when I try and touch them when I get drunk. I do not get cranky. Yeah, whatever. I guess that's just your captain, please assist in your attempts to do something that makes me highly uncomfortable face. What? Why are you looking at me like that? I fail to see how a small difference in cartilage formation can create such fascination. You could always talk to Nate in sociology. Ah, that may be unwise. Seriously? Nate is responsible for that? His reputation for accuracy has certainly been compromised. I'll say. Seriously, he bit your ear? Eventually. Eventually? I would prefer not to go into the specifics of the encounter. Yeah, I can see that. You're wearing your cranky face again. Captain. Here, put this on. We'll go see Bones and get rid of those teeth marks. But seriously, there wasn't even a tingle. Your hearing's so good, I thought you'd feel something different than humans. Sometimes ears are simply ears, Jim. McCoy. Seriously, if McCoy is going to have to keep guarding this goddamn Vulcan from the rest of the crew like he's some kind of endangered species... And McCoy winces at the simile that strikes too close to what Spock actually is. He's going to start doling out sedatives when people ask for aphrodisiacs. He doesn't keep those kinds of things in his sick bay, thank you, and he certainly doesn't want to overhear crew members talking about their plans for them, especially when they involve green-blooded first officers. Spock has no problem fending off his would-be admirers if the dislocated shoulder McCoy fixed on Lieutenant Commander Matthews from sociology was any proof. Nate might have been mighty tight-lipped about the whole thing, either embarrassed or angry or both, but McCoy hadn't been too sympathetic when Spock had shown up with that bite mark on his ear, and Jim and Toad to explain everything.
McCoy does not get paid enough for this job.
Still, McCoy goes on missions when the kid asks, because Spock has a hard time keeping Jim out of trouble on his good days, and with half the Enterprise fawning over him, McCoy doesn't trust Spock to be his most attentive. With visions of two bodies getting dragged up from the planet's surface, McCoy had gladly accepted the invitation, or order, he supposed, to beam down. Of course, then Jim was fine, but it was Spock that needed some patching up later. Goddamn aliens too, Spock? What are you, wearing a sign that says, "Please try your harebrained seduction attempts on me?" "As you can see, Dr. McCoy," Spock replies, and McCoy'll be damned, he sounds annoyed. There is no sign. McCoy mutters something, cursing when Spock flinches. Hold still, man! I do not see the need for this procedure, Spock answers primly. Surely this can wait until we are back on the ship. Head wounds bleed away like you wouldn't believe, and we've got next to none Vulcan blood on board, so you'll stay put until I stitch you up. McCoy tugs a little harder than necessary on the suture. Sure, they've got dermal regenerators and all that fancy Starfleet-issued stuff, but McCoy'll put his faith in older remedies that suited humanity just fine for hundreds of years. Of course, the other reason is that the dermal regenerator is too damn big to put in his pack, but he's not telling Spock that. Spock says nothing to McCoy's order, but he follows it and acts like a perfect patient he normally is. Any idea where they got the idea that throwing rocks at your head was a good way to ask out on a date? McCoy asks after a moment of silence. Spock shifts, just slightly. Unnoticeable to anyone but Jim, McCoy, and Uhura. Spock says in a careful tone, Vulcans were a barbaric race before the teachings of Sorak. Perhaps only that knowledge of Vulcans has reached this planet. So they thought they'd throw rocks at you and try and rip your arms off? McCoy grumbles, looking at the arms Spock has in a makeshift sling. Gold sling, of course. Jim can't ever resist an opportunity to take his shirt off, apparently. A display of strength, I believe, was the intention, much like the mating rituals of several animals on Earth. Crazy bastards. McCoy ties off the suture. I know you're not telling me something. I'm not an idiot, but I'm not going to make you tell me either. Just keep yourself away from any more mistaken stereotypes and displays of strength. Spock nods his thanks. McCoy flips open his communicator. This is McCoy, 2 to beam up. And then it gets worse. Another routine mission had gone wrong, and McCoy is about 2 glasses of brandy away from calling up Starfleet and chewing them out. Uhura would open a line for him up in a second, he knows, but he'd still like to keep his job. McCoy runs down the corridors of the ship to the transporter room. McCoy doesn't know who's hurt or how bad, but he's had just about enough of Starfleet sending in men blind to situations. He's only gotten pieces of what Scotty had said, but the words actually inhabited, hostile, and grudge against the Federation had gotten his feet moving. McCoy skids around the corner into the transporter room just as the pad shimmers with energy. His eyes fix on the outline of 2 people slumped together in one section. When they come into view, McCoy swallows hard. It's Spock and Jim. It's always Spock and Jim. He's gotten to know their bodies better than anyone else's, the number of times he's patched them both up. So whatever they were missing back on, or their flesh back together and made them wait it out until the danger had passed, just in time to send him in again. Bones, Jim says, looking relieved as he stumbles off the pad with Spock. His shirt is missing, again, but McCoy doesn't stop to wonder where it's gone. I'm fine. Get Spock. And he is fine, McCoy can see, because he's gotten damn fine at telling when Jim's lying to him. But he's got streaks of green all over him, which, McCoy realizes with a sinking feeling, are streaks of Spock's blood. He pounces on the Vulcan, tricorder out and scanning. God damn it, McCoy mutters, realizing where Jim's shirt has gotten to. The bandage wrapped around both of Spock's hands are too soaked in copper-based blood for the color to be recognizable. But McCoy is sure that the rags were once command gold. He doesn't like the readings he's getting much, either. Sickbay, now, McCoy says, getting under Spock's other shoulder. Spock is mostly unresponsive, but he walks. Between Jim and McCoy, they get him into a bed, and McCoy starts cutting off the remains of Jim's shirt. McCoy knows what he'll find, but that's still no kind of preparation to see someone's hands sliced open, someone's fingers crushed and bent at all the wrong angles. Sadistic bastards, McCoy is snarling. Spock's not bleeding anywhere else, but whoever took a knife to his hands knew what they were doing. There's a lot of blood vessels in the hands. Get a blade in at the right angle and they'll bleed away. Doctor, all I require is time and I can use a healing trance to reverse the damage. Spock protests weakly when McCoy sets to work. Like hell, McCoy snaps. Hold him still, Jim. I'm gonna have to rebuild bones. It's gonna hurt. Pain is only in the mind, Spock says, but he's turning a nasty pale color. Whatever you say, Spock, McCoy replies, and settles in for a long night. They get everything patched and put back the way it belongs, but it takes hours, and McCoy is shaking by the time he's finished. Spock is unconscious for half of it, and there's at least one shift change before McCoy calls it quits. Jim gets them both a glass of something that smells like paint thinner, and they drink it in the heavy silence. Didn't know it had hurt him that bad, Jim says, finally. McCoy shakes his head, in agreement, in an attempt to dislodge the memory of the howl that had ripped from Spock's throat when he reset Spock's fingers. Vulcans have sensitive hands, McCoy replies hoarsely. Didn't think about how sensitive until now. Jim goes back to the bridge, and Chekhov takes Spock's place at the science station. When Spock wakes up, he's ordered to rest, and McCoy bandages his hands with some splints to keep the healing on track. He sends Spock back to his quarters and says nothing about the screams still ringing in his ears. McCoy passes out in his office and doesn't wake until Jim comes looking for him hours later. I sent a report to Starfleet, Jim says when McCoy asks. I was sure to include your comments. My comments? McCoy croaks and runs a hand over his face. Jim nods. Vindictive bastards. Goddamn misplaced anger. You know. McCoy grunts. Good. Maybe they'll stop sending you two into suicide missions. Jim grips his shoulder and says nothing. Spock heals slowly, but McCoy did a fine job on the treatment, and his bones start working like they did before. Spock is not thrilled when McCoy orders him to have weekly physical therapy sessions, and is limited to only a few hours in the science labs until his hands have made a complete recovery. The day he's allowed to return to his place on the bridge is the day McCoy turns up, snarling. "Just what in the hell do you think you're doing?" McCoy snaps, storming out of the turbo lift. "My job, Doctor," Spock replies without looking up. The rest of the bridge, however, including Jim, is watching in rapt fascination as McCoy stops over and spins Spock's chair around. "You missed your physical therapy session," McCoy growls. "You're not cleared to go back to work." "I assure you, my hands are in perfect working order." "Now, listen here, you pointy-eared bastard. I'm the doctor on this ship, and I will be the one determining that. Got it?" Spock's mouth thins. Vulcans are very attuned to their own physiology, and as such... "Put a cork in it, Spock!" McCoy snaps and snatches Spock's wrist. "If you aren't going to come to sickbay to get your goddamn session, then I'll do it up here." He holds Spock's right hand, palm up, and uses his other hand to gently test Spock's fingers. "Now, tell me if this hurts, even if it's just a twinge." "Doctor," Spock starts, posture stiffening. "It'll only take a minute, then you can go back to your staring contest with space." McCoy assumes the discomfort is because Spock's being put on spot in front of the whole bridge, so he ignores it and holds on tighter when Spock tries to pull away. He doesn't notice that, though everyone else gets bored and goes back to work, Uhura and Jim still watch him sharply. "My fingers are in fine working order, Doctor," Spock tries again. "If you will cease..." McCoy brushes him off, but the slight fluster in Spock's speech has left him suspicious. "Something you're not telling me? Any of this hurting?" "No," Spock answers, trying to pull away again. "No, I can assure you I am feeling no pain." "Humph," McCoy snorts and digs his thumb into the center of Spock's palm. Behind him, Uhura's eyes bulge, and when she glances over at Jim, she sees him fighting not to laugh. "Might I suggest," Spock yelps, or as close to yelping as Vulcans get, shooting to his feet and forcing McCoy to step back. "Might I suggest continuing this in sickbay, Doctor?" "Sure, now you want to go? Listen here, Spock, I am not some trick pony that you can..." "Bones," Jim says, and McCoy doesn't notice him struggling to keep a straight face. "Take him down to sickbay." McCoy shrugs and leads the way to the turbo lift. He eyes Spock, who is looking anywhere else but at him, with suspicion. McCoy practically manhandles Spock into sickbay and turns to get his tricorder, which will give him some accurate readings. When he turns back to face Spock, he finds the Vulcan maintaining a safe distance. "What?" McCoy wants to know. "Is emotion contagious now?" "Dr. McCoy, I believe I should inform you of some cultural issues before we continue." "You're stalling." "I am not." "All right, fine. Tell me what I'm scanning." And McCoy grabs Spock's hands again. He pushes his thumb into Spock's palm again and holds it there. "Leonard," Spock pleads. And boy, does that get McCoy's attention. "If you continue along this line of action, I cannot be held responsible for what I do in response." "For what? What in the hell are you talking about?" "Four Vulcans. Hands are highly sensitive, partially due to our touch telepathy. However, there are other cultural connotations that do not translate exactly in terms to humans."
"You mean like now?"
McCoy clarifies.
"Yes, like now."
"All right, Spock, I'll bite. What's this mean to the rest of you Vulcans?"
"I think a demonstration would perhaps be the best manner in which to convey this," Spock says faintly, and McCoy barely has time to register that before he is shoved up against one of the lab tables and there's a hot mouth sliding against his own.
Reflexively, McCoy's grip tightens on Spock's hand, and the damn Vulcan makes some kind of low growl that makes other parts of McCoy perk up in interest. Oh, fuck. And his mind reel. Later, when his sanity comes back to him, McCoy will realize that he grabbed Spock by the front of his shirt, hauled him closer, and proceeded to make out with Spock like they were both teenagers. Spock is the first to pull back, but doesn't step away. McCoy just stares at him, frozen in his half-slump against the table, his hands still clutching Spock's. Fascinating, Spock murmurs after a few moments of silence have ticked by. You're speechless. His head dips, nose pressing into the side of McCoy's neck. I must employ this tactic more often. Now hang on a second, McCoy snaps. Just what do you think you're doing, assaulting an officer of Starfleet and... If y'all weren't so particular about your secrets, things like this wouldn't happen. Spock agrees, turning McCoy's hand palm up and licking up the length of McCoy's fingers. I ought to... goddamn hobgoblins and their... Oh, fuck it. McCoy shoves Spock back onto one of the cots, following him down. What else are you sensitive, then? The corner of Spock's mouth twitches up into a smirk. I believe they say that half the fun is in the discovery. And then, of course, it gets awkward. Spock's hands okay, Bones? Jim asks when he waltzes into sickbay at the end of his shift. Spock has already hightailed it back to his quarters, and McCoy had pretended not to notice the satisfied smirk on Spock's lips when he wriggled back into his uniform. Of course, if he had noticed it, McCoy could have then been brought up on charges for neglecting his post because he was too busy investigating Vulcan and human cultural differences. Better than that, I'd say, McCoy answers with his customary scowl and doesn't look up from the paperwork in front of him. Soon as he gets his pile of stuff done, he can chase that smirking Vulcan into his quarters and have a real investigation behind closed doors and in a bed that doesn't monitor pulse rates or breathing patterns. Good, Jim says, startling McCoy back to the present. That the only reason you came down here? That, and I promised Uhura I'd deliver a threatening speech about treating Spock right or else she'll find a way to reroute all the crew's pornography onto your medical computer. The stylus in McCoy's hand snaps under the force of his grip, and he stares at Jim. What? What? Jim reaches over and pats his cheek. You kids be safe now. Use protection. He turns and heads for the door, calling over his shoulder. Oh, and don't touch his ears. McCoy drops his forehead to his desk with a dull thunk. Figure he'd end up with a tight-lipped Vulcan as a bedmate on a ship with the loosest-lipped crew in the history of the fleet. The end. Author's notes. This story was written for the STXI kink meme prompt, a 5-in-1 about all the different things that are supposed to be Vulcan aphrodisiacs, but totally aren't. Everyone wants on Spock, but no one knows how to bag a Vulcan. There must be all kinds of urban legends surrounding secretive Vulcans. Go wild with your imagination, Anon. The result is people attempting to seduce Spock using all kinds of weird techniques they hear are surefire ways into his pants, but he is not fazed at all. And then one person gets it very, very, very right. Bonus points if whoever succeeds does so on accident. So, not all of these are aphrodisiacs, so much they are seduction tactics. But, you know, aside from that, I followed the prompt.